Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation as part of the club's Good Lit series. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Naomi Starkman, founder and editor-in-chief of Civil Eats, your moderator tonight. And it is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Mark Bittman.
Thank you.
A food columnist at the New York Times, Mark is one of the most impassioned and opinionated observers of the food landscape in the United States, covering everything from policy and agriculture to health and the environment. He is the author of more than a dozen books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, VB6, Eat Vegan Before Six, and the James Beard Award-winning cookbook, Jean Georges, Cooking at Home with a Four-Star Chef. His 1998 cookbook, How to Cook Everything, which won the IACP Julia Child Award, the James Beard Award, and three international cookbook awards, has over 1 million copies sold and has since been turned into a successful app. A regular on the Today Show, Mark has also hosted several TV series, including his own PBS series, Bittman Takes on America's Chefs, which was awarded the Best National TV Cooking Series of 2005 by the James Beard Foundation. His latest book is A Bone to Pick, The Good and Bad News About Food, with wisdom and advice on diets, food safety, GMOs, farming, and more. And we're delighted to have him here with us to discuss it tonight. So I actually had the pleasure of meeting Mark first in 2008 when he wrote a seminal column for the New York Times, and it was not in the dining section, it was actually in the world section, called Rethinking the Meat Guzzler. And I was so grateful that somebody was writing about issues around animal agriculture that I wrote him an email, and he wrote me back, and we became friends, and we've been friends and colleagues since then, and I'm enormously grateful to Mark for shining such an important spotlight in a major newspaper on these issues that I personally and professionally care about so much, and I know many of you here tonight do as well. This book, and I hope many of you will buy it tonight, is really an incredible compilation of Mark's column since he's been writing, including The Meat Guzzler, Rethinking the Meat Guzzler. He started his column in 2011, and the title was A Food Manifesto for the Future. So I wanted to go back to that original column and sort of use it as a yardstick to measure progress over that period.
Yeah, progress.
Or not. In it, you made a number of suggestions, which you said you think it's safe for most, that most food activists would agree with. Among those were ending subsidies to processed food.
No.
Breaking up the Department of Agriculture and empowering the Food and Drug Administration.
No.
Outlaw concentrated animal feeding operations.
No.
Encourage and subsidize home cooking.
No.
Tax the marketing and sale of unhealthful foods.
In Berkeley. And by the way, in Mexico, a first world country.
Mandate truth in labeling.
No, labeling has gotten marginally better. I think we'd agree.
So you wrote in a column on May 6th recently, which is not obviously not in this book, and it was called Let's Make Food Issues Real. And you said you looked back at all these this first column, but you looked back at a number of your stories, and you said you would also add, remove the routine use of antibiotics from food production.
No.
Radical improvement and expansion of the school lunch program.
I often say that the most progressive thing that the Obama administration has done food-wise in 7 years or 6 years, whatever it is the Healthy, Hungry, Free Kids Act of 2010. So that, we get a B. That's the only thing on the list.
And ensure that there is land for people who want to grow real food on it.
Yeah, zero.
So the question here, obviously based on those items or things that you were hopeful for, and perhaps for many of us in the Bay Area, which might for many of us and maybe in other places in the world be considered the home of the local food revolution, is what have we seen? Where are there some advances and where is there some hope?
Oh, well, as I said, school lunches have gotten better. I suppose there's been a little more support for people growing non-commodity crops. The biggest stride has been in food chain workers, and it took everybody completely by surprise. And when the fight for $15 minimum wage started 2 years ago, it was completely mocked. Even optimistic people said, or even allies said, this is really good, but it's never going to happen. And now we have Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, all with a $15 minimum wage being phased in, Oakland, $12.50, St. Louis, very soon to vote positively on $15, it looks like. New York cannot be far behind, and once New York does this, then I don't see how Philadelphia, Chicago, maybe even Dallas cannot do it. So I think within a span of 5 years, and there'll be a phase-in period because none of these things that people promise do they actually deliver immediately, but okay. But within a span of, say, 3 or 5 years, I think we'll see 40 or 50 or maybe 70 million low-wage workers have their wages raised from as little as $2.13 an hour plus tips for tipped workers, or $7 an hour for those covered by the federal minimum wage, or $9 an hour for those covered by California, for example, minimum wage, to $12 or $15 an hour. That's huge. How did that happen? Mass action. That's how that happened. No one waited for President Obama promising $10.10 an hour federal minimum wage, which would be nice if pathetic, but it isn't even going to happen. No one waited for the states to do these things, which states have raised minimum wages, but they've raised them from $7 to $7.50 phased in, or $8 to $9 phased in. This is in Los Angeles, $9 to $15 phased in over 5 years, pretty impressive. And why did it happen? Because people got out and made noise and demonstrated and found allies and allied with traditional unions and really fought.
And it's a really important point because it's one of the few instances in which there's this whole, you know, theory that there's a food movement right now, and I'm going to ask you whether you actually think there is a food movement. But this food movement, if it exists, could really take a lesson or a page out of the Book of Labor and the organizing that's been happening there. Do you think that now, because you just wrote a really powerful column last week, and it was called "Can We Finally Treat Food Workers Fairly?" where you sort of laid out this sort of historic, systemic effort on the part of labor organizers to really talk about labor in the food system. Do you think that there are some other lessons in the food movement around organizing that can be learned?
Well, I hope so, but you know, you're getting into a place where you're asking me to figure out things that are really hard to figure out. And if I knew the answers, there's no secrets here. I was among those who was not skeptical about the fight for 15, but thought, well, this is really cool. Be interesting to see where it goes. There's no way I would have been optimistic about it. There's no way anyone in this room 20 years ago would have thought that we'd be seeing gay marriage legalized nationally in the early part of the 21st century, and yet that's going to happen, or let's say it's likely to happen. I think we have to identify what issues are important. I think we have to talk about them. I think we have to organize as best we can and build as best we can. I think we have to be prepared for success, which is a funny thing because we're, to the extent that we've been working on this stuff, we just assume failure because we've been encouraged. We've been taught that we should assume failure. But I think if we're ready to seize opportunities and we're ready to make noise and we're ready to support candidates or campaigns that are going in the right direction, I think things can happen. I mean, there's a lot of stuff we don't talk about that happens on a local level that can be really quite important and impactful. And if I'm talking about, say, we were talking about federal food procurement on the way out here, and I'm skeptical about that. I know you are too, but LA's food procurement program is really quite fabulous, and there are other cities that are moving in that direction. So, gee, what happens if you have sort of a statewide food procurement thing in California among public institutions? That's a pretty serious move. I don't know where the opportunities lie. I do know I thought that we'd see an end to the routine use of antibiotics during the course of in animal production during the course of the Obama administration. It doesn't seem like it's going to happen. They just make up one like soft law rule after another, and they don't do anything. I'd like to think that we could see the people who produce our food, without whom we don't have food, so their value is incalculable. I'd like to see that those kinds of people were treated fairly, which means, you know, $15 an hour, $20 an hour, 40-hour weeks, health benefits, guaranteed year-round employment, that kind of thing. I don't know how to make that happen. I mean, and then, of course, as you know, you get into issues that are not food issues because the money has to come from somewhere, so then you get into social justice issues, and it gets very, very complicated.
It is very complicated, and you've written quite a lot about social equity, inequality, poverty being tied to a lot of the issues, and I think people are now more now perhaps connecting the dots. I want to go back to the question, though, I kind of hinted at, which is whether you think there is a coherent food movement in the United States.
I used to say I believed that there was a food movement when people who said they were in the food movement showed an interest in workers in the food chain. And that has kind of happened. But I guess I still don't think there's a food movement. Because now I think we have to be able to have the power to push candidates to talk about food and to talk about food in the way we want them to talk about it, to talk about the issues we think are important, and to take the right stand on those issues. So when we go to community meetings, when we go to caucuses, when we talk to congressional candidates, but also when we talk to municipal candidates, can we get them to focus on whatever our local or national food concerns are? Can we get, you know, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in a room and get them to talk about a national food policy, or just to get them to agree to a statement like, all Americans deserve food that's green, nutritious, affordable, and fair. Can we talk about what fair food might be? Can we talk about what green food might be? If we can push candidates to talk about that stuff, that's a major success, and that's the sign, I think, of a powerful movement. We don't have that now. One of our problems is that we haven't built the right, this is maybe getting a little wonky, but and you'll have to forgive me because I've done like 5 interviews in the last 2 days, so it just gets funneled into this. But we have an allied with organizations in health movement, in the environmental movement, in whatever movement there is. They don't recognize that food can be and is a force, and we haven't made it adequately a force. And at some point, we have to build those alliances, and we have to say, here's what we can bring to the table. We can bring you 100,000 signatures. We can bring people out for a demonstration. We can get a congressperson elected or defeated on the basis of their food policy or lack thereof. That would be significant. I don't think it's far away, but it's not here.
I mean, there's some groups that are working on that food policy action is trying to do a congressional scorecard to sort of rate your elected representative based on his or her food policy votes or not, and they were pretty successful in defeating a candidate who was pretty anti-food stamps. Do you think that, I mean, what can the average person do? Is it a matter of writing his or her elected representative? There are food policy councils. There's food policy councils all over the Bay Area. How would you advise, you know, anybody sitting in this room to sort of take that step for actually reaching out to his or her elected official to tell them that they care about these issues?
Well, I haven't, you know, there are food policy councils, but I haven't seen them do a whole hell of a lot yet. But, you know, I'd like to see that. I think that we've all learned and we've seen that important change right now is happening on municipal and state levels before it's happening on federal levels. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, but I would work on, if I were a parent right now, I'd be working on school lunches. If I were not a parent, well, I'm both, but I'm a parent of children not in school. So I would work on municipal issues. I would figure out what issue made the most sense in my town or city, and I would work on that, and I would also work to get progressive congresspeople elected and people who will include food in their agenda. Right now, there are probably, well, you'd know this better than I, what, 30 congressmen who can talk articulately about food systems out of 450? 20? 10? How many? Three? Shelley Pingree.
Just a
Shelley
few.
Shelley Pingree, Ron Blumenauer.
A handful.
Yeah, a handful.
Yeah.
Well, we need more of those people. I mean, I love Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders can't talk articulately about food issues. He can talk brilliantly about inequality, but he doesn't know. He can't talk about food. He can talk about dairy in Vermont. That's what I'm talking about. Well, which is not nothing, and it's representative of some important things, but he can't talk about farm workers in Salinas. I can tell you that. He has a lot to learn about that stuff.
And speaking of which, you've been spending a lot of time in California. You recently relocated here. You're a fellow at the UC Berkeley Berkeley Food Institute. You were teaching at the Edible Education, and you've been writing a lot about California. You wrote a column today about almonds and the drought, and you've been out on the road with this new cool video project.
Almonds, by the way.
Oh, sorry.
where are you from, anyway?
I'm from here. And you've been kind of documenting California in a new way, maybe with a different set of eyes, being here on the ground. Obviously, you're enjoying the bounty of the farmers markets. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about what's changed for you now that you're in California. What are you seeing differently, perhaps, with an eye towards the ground, seeing these big farms in Salinas and other smaller projects around the state?
Well, I think there's a... there's a little bit about being in the Bay Area that's confusing and deceptive, which is that the scene is so great that it's easy to imagine that it could happen everywhere. But it's been great this way for 20 years, and it's not happening everywhere. A lot of the models of alternative agriculture and alternative structures may be hard to scale up and may be hard to replicate. And then again, you go an hour from here, or 2 hours from here, well, an hour from here, and you see the real belly of the beast. You see real industrial agriculture at its most productive and scariest. And you begin to wonder, or I've begun to wonder, what incremental changes can happen in big-scale agriculture. Small changes, perhaps, changes that growers can agree to, that will make, because of the scale, will have much, much greater impact than working on alternative structures will. I'm not saying we shouldn't work on alternative structures. I'm saying there's a bit of a focus here, or a bit of a tunnel vision of not seeing the big picture, and the big picture includes both alternatives and the so-called enemy. How do you make industrial agriculture better? Because I hear things all the time. I hear people say, it's almost like listening to Leninists talk about the state. You hear people say, well, industrial agriculture is just going to go away. Well, it's not. Or, well, if you improve industrial agriculture, you're just lengthening the lifespan of something that needs to end tomorrow. Well, it's not ending tomorrow. And if you can make incremental positive changes in industrial agriculture, you can have an impact on so many things. And a 5% increase on a farm that's 3,000 acres, a 5% improvement on anything on a farm that's 3,000 acres is a significant improvement. And, you know, I started to think this when I was down in Salinas a couple of weeks ago, which I think Monterey County has like 1 million acres under cultivation, some number like that. It's like ridiculous. It's not even conceivable. And you go down there and you see section after section after section planted in the same crop. Usually it's a green, you know, lettuce, for example. And you think, well, what? There must be some way to make the lettuce production on these fields somewhat more sustainable that no one's thought of or that no one's negotiated with the growers around. Some improvement in the environment for critters and pollinators, some improvement in the conditions of workers that, you know, somehow is the growers see as affordable, some gleaning operation that used to happen and doesn't happen anymore, some method of reusing waste to improve the soil and cutting back on chemical fertilizers, on and on and on. I'm sure I'm not the first person to think of this stuff, but in a way, it took me being here, and I've been interested in Central Valley agriculture for a long time, but I think being here and seeing these things and being more of a part of the community has sort of, and also living in Berkeley where the alternative ag stuff is just so dominant, it's sort of made me more conscious of this dichotomy and made me want to think more about improving big scale ag.
And you know, it's an interesting point because I think when you look at California, you know, you have Salinas and then you have Silicon Valley and Salinas Valley, and they're right next to each other. And some might say never the twain shall meet. And yet there's a huge interest in tech and food, and there's tons of food-like products being made, Just Mayo by Hampton Creek or Soylent or Beyond Meat, so sort of food-like substances. And at the same time,
techie processed food,
right. Exactly. And at the same time, everything you just described is this real opportunity to invest, take tech, create a perhaps applicable software solution to disrupt big ag, as I guess the tech folks would say. Where are you seeing some interesting things? I mean, you've spent some time in Silicon Valley. There's a ton of things that are online. One of the questions from the audience was some of these services like Blue Apron. Where is there some movement around tech and food that you think are, you know, things that are interesting or hopeful?
Well, I mean, I agree with your implication that some of these new hyper-processed foods that happen to be vegan are not necessarily moving in the right direction. I spent 35 years trying to get people to cook. I mean, I can remember the day it started. And I don't know how successful I've been, but it would be disruptive to get people to cook at home more, but I don't know how to do that. If Blue Apron is an answer to that question, I'm all for it. If Blue Apron can source better quality stuff, Blue Apron can form alliances with local foods around the country, or if Blue Apron can treat its workers well and so on, I'm all for that. I haven't seen I've heard some tech stuff described that sounded sort of appealing, but mostly what I hear coming out of tech is, let's create the ideal fake food, or let's mechanize farms even more so they can be even smarter. And there is this sort of tech attitude that, well, workers are just going to have to fend for themselves. And I'm sure ultimately that's true, but I don't know that I want to be a part of that. Again, if I had, you know, I'd be in Silicon Valley right now negotiating a deal if I had the right answer to your question. So
you've been called the foodie version of a warmonger.
Who called me that?
Somebody who's very well known in the sort of big ag world. And first of all, I know you don't like the word foodie.
I think the word foodie needs help. I don't not like it. I just think it needs a little bit of tweaking to have more meaning.
Okay.
If it means I can get a table tonight at 8 o'clock at, you know, Bennu, I don't want to be a foodie. If it means I support good things happening in the world of food, I do want to be a foodie. So when someone defines it in a better way, I wrote this column. It's probably in this book, you know.
And so I guess the question is, if you are a foodie warmonger, is there a war? And if there's a war, are we winning?
Well, if there's a war, we've lost. There's a struggle. I don't know if there's a war. There's a struggle. As I said, we need to form alliances. We need to flex our muscles a little bit. We need to gain some power. We need to use that power. It's not a shooting war, but there are people who are making money now for bad reasons, and they have to make less money. So they won't do that willingly. So it's a struggle.
One of the questions from the audience, and it's something I wanted to ask you as well. You have an entire chapter in the book devoted to meat. It's called What's Wrong with Meat? And you have several columns where you write about meat from a different perspective. You've talked to yourself through all of your books, Vegan Before Six. I was hoping you could talk to the audience a little bit about what helped you, how you got to make a decision about reducing your meat intake, and what you think it's going to take for the rest of the country to catch on.
I mean, for me, it was an intersection of understanding the contribution of industrial agriculture to climate change and understanding the contribution of the overconsumption of meat to other environmental problems and to nutritional problems. I actually have, you know, I've come to think that moderate amounts of meat and animal products are fine to eat. So it's really a question of overconsumption. It's a question of, can we limit environmental damage? I mean, everything has impact, but certainly things can have less impact than concentrated animal feeding operations. And can we figure out how to reduce agriculture's contribution to climate change? Those were all important issues to me. And Food Matters, which I wrote before VB6, which was not a dissimilar book, and VB6 did well. And I think, I mean, if we ask, I mean, we can do this. How many people in this room eat less meat than they did 10 years ago?
So
it's like everybody.
It's a big show of hands.
I mean, how many don't? It's like seven. So I'm not exaggerating either. So it's not like I'm a thought leader here or anything. It's the way it is. I'm part of the wave, and the wave is people eat less meat than they used to. The question, to some extent, is what are they eating instead? And I think there's sort of two rules only that really matter in food. One is to eat less hyper-processed food, less junk, to sort of say the 80% of the food that's in most supermarkets that contains sugar is probably not important to eat. Some of it is probably falls closer to poison, the definition of poison, than the definition of food. Some of it, you know, like really good ice cream is a luxury item that we all understand we can't eat three times a day. We have to take that food as a group and put it on one side and say, what is it in that group that I want to eat, and how much of it am I going to allow myself to eat of it? And the answer should be not much. Then we take everything that's left, which includes real meat and dairy and fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and so on, plants. And we say, we all know this, which is why people are eating less meat. We all know we should be eating more plants than we used to. So then that rule is just to eat more plants this week than last week, and this month than last month, and this year than last year, and then repeat that. And those are the sort of two rules about having a decent diet that matter. Nothing else really does. And, you know, meat and dairy can be a part of that diet. Needless to say, it's nice if you can support sustainable meat and dairy. It's nice if things can be organic and fair trade and all of that. But for most people, following those two rules would improve our health, would reduce the impact of the way we eat on the environment, would improve animal welfare, would get a whole lot of stuff done. But it's sort of hard to get 350 million people to agree on things and then all move in the same direction at once. So
we need regulations, we need rules, we need ongoing education, we need controls.
And I guess a follow-up question to that is, how do we get people to cook more? I mean, you're such an advocate of cooking, you have so many cookbooks, and people, for a variety of reasons, either can't, don't want to, or aren't able to cook. How do you encourage people to cook? How do they start?
Right, well, baby boomers have been notoriously bad cooks, and whatever the, or notoriously infrequent cooks, and it's gonna get, and the generations of, especially later boomers, even worse than earlier boomers. But that's going to get worse because as people's kids leave home, there's less of an incentive to cook. It's, you're much more likely to cook for four people than you are to cook for two people, and you're much more likely to cook for two people than you are to cook for one person, and I think most people would agree with that, and we've seen it in our own lives. Millennials seem to be cooking a little bit, but you have these kind of anti-cooking forces in the world at large. The forces of convenience. And again, it's hard to counter. There are people I think are smart who say it's not coming back. I mean, if we were sitting here discussing sewing, dressmaking, we'd have a hard time making a case for why people should start making their own clothing again. Cooking is not unlike making clothing. Maybe we just haven't seen the writing on the wall yet, and it's really dead, except for people who do it as a hobby. I mean, it's too late for me. I'm so invested in it, but I don't know how to turn this ship around. I've tried, and it may be that meal kits are a way to go. And it may be that my ideas about cooking, which would include cooking classes and communal kitchens and subsidizing cooking equipment for people who can't afford it and so on, are just not going to happen at this stage. So, I mean, I can answer how we can get people to cook more, but I can't institute the programs that I would advocate. So, I don't know.
Maybe in schools, I mean, there's a whole movement to get kids to, you know, cook in schools and have more culinary education,
well,
literacy.
Nutrition education. People don't know. I mean, if people understood nutrition, they'd cook more. But We're teaching our kids that life is more fun when you drink Coca-Cola and eat donuts. If that's what we're teaching our kids, there's no reason for them to cook.
Well, talk a little bit about that. I mean, you have written quite extensively on junk food marketing to kids. Be curious, you know, where your thoughts are on that right now.
I think it's one of the top three issues. I think if you want to see a healthier America, you want to see people eating better, which would, of course, affect agriculture as well. If you want to see that 30 years from now, you have to stop being able to tell two-year-olds that what I just said, life is more fun when you drink soda and eat junk. We all know, every single person in this room knows how hard it is to break the habits of eating that you learn when you're a kid. Some of us have done it more successfully than others, but all of us have struggled with that. If you teach kids to eat well, they will grow up to be adults who eat well. If you teach kids to eat crap, they will struggle with that for their entire lives. We're sending mixed messages to kids. We've improved school lunches. We tell kids, eat your vegetables. And then we allow people to try to sell kids sugary beverages, sugary cereals, nutritionally worthless stuff. And we allow people to try to sell those kids from the time the kids can swipe an iPhone, which is 18 months, I think. And I'm not kidding. I mean, we have more pedestrians in New York than we have here, but it's not uncommon to see people wheeling strollers with little tiny kids in them in New York, and the kids have iPhones or iPads that the parents are not in control of what these kids are watching. I mean, they think they are, but we all know what the internet's like.
On the other side of the cooking coin is what you alluded to, which is, you know, there's such a plethora of options for eating now. And so one of the questions from the audience is whether casual dining such as Chipotle, and I know you dream often of good fast food. The question is whether these are better for us, either nutritionally or otherwise.
If you think McDonald's is fast food 1.0 and you think, I think it's fair to call Chipotle and Panera and maybe some others fast food 2.0, but I think we're really waiting for fast food 3.0 and we haven't seen it. I do not think that starting a fast food chain that sells salads is really gonna take off. I mean, I think we all know that we should eat more salad, and we probably do eat more salad, but salads are not gonna have the appeal of double cheeseburgers anytime soon, and there's gotta be some way to, I mean, I've put a lot of thought into this, all perhaps wasted thought, I don't know, but there's gotta be a way to say, to get people into places where they're buying good food at reasonable prices, and that's an advancement beyond Chipotle. I know Chipotle would like to see that also.
Here's a food question for you. How does the food compare in Berkeley or California to New York?
Well, food's an all-encompassing word. So the ingredients here are incomparable. I'll say that. I mean, it's easier to buy great ingredients, to find great ingredients here than anywhere I've ever been. It's unbelievable. Last night I probably had the best cherries I've ever had in my life last night. And I know when I buy cherries, I mean, this is silly, but fine. When I buy cherries back east, I think, okay, well, like, I'm going to buy this bag of cherries. Looks really good. And I'm going to expect or hope that one out of three of those cherries is really great. And that's not a bad ratio where I come from. And last night I was at this woman's house and she put two bowls of cherries on the table. Every single cherry was mind-blowing. Every one. It was like, how do you stop eating them? And you stopped eating them because they were too sweet, if anything. Like they were a little, they could have had a little more acid. So you get into this, like, well, that could be a tiny bit sour. I could eat 10 more if it was a little. Also, they were the size of small plums.
Do you know where they were from? You'll tweet about it later.
I could. I think they were from a U Picket place. But don't start. I know you all have your favorites.
Cherries are amazing, and they're especially good this year. What are some of the?
It's because of the drought.
It is. What are some of the other farms that you visited that you've experiences you've had besides cherries that you would like to share with us? I know you had a great experience with Meyer Lemons.
Well, the Meyer Lemon tree is outside my kitchen door.
So that was
hard not to have a good experience.
That was one of the questions. Are you growing your own food? What are you? Are you, and I don't know. You're not.
I'm growing my own Meyer Lemons. I share a little property with some neighbors, and we have some stuff planted, and we have a little water, and. We'll have lettuces, and well, I bet we have tomatoes and cucumbers, and we'll see. We'll have arugula, but I mean, other neighbors, even on my block, are like well into zucchini, and they're past their first harvest of lettuces, and they've got beans, and their peas are already gone, and we're like, we planted some stuff. I mean, it'll be really good compared to what my gardens back east have been like, but we planted some stuff.
And I think you've said recently.
There's not a lot of incentive when you have these farmers markets where you just walk down the street and, you buy this, you buy it. It's, I mean, peas are $2 a pound, it's like crazy.
And you've said that your cooking has become more simple because the ingredients are so fresh.
Right, you start sounding like Alice Waters. Like you buy good stuff and you don't mess it up.
It's a good rule. And to that point, someone from the audience asked whether, and we talked about this on the way over here, whether urban or suburban agriculture can make a significant contribution to our food supply, or will it remain a cottage industry?
I don't even know if it's a cottage industry, but there's nothing wrong with it. But I think this goes back to what I was saying before. I think the alternative structures are great, but we have to work on changing big ag and making it better. I have a garden. I mean, I just denigrated it for 5 minutes, but I think urban ag is great. And, you just reminded me that I said the other day, I don't remember where, but
48% of all fruits and vegetables in the United States came from Victory Gardens during World War II. That's half. I don't think those days are coming back, but certainly 10% of, if 10% of our fruits and vegetables came from gardens and in cities and in suburbs, that would be really, really cool. But it's not going to solve, you know, it's not going to solve the problem. We are denuding the earth of its soil health. We're poisoning our water, we're poisoning our air. Urban ag is not going to fix that.
Here's a question from the audience about whether we should eat it to save it. This is a question about whether eating fish is depleting the oceans. What are your thoughts on that?
The fish is very, very tricky. I dread this question, but it comes up all the time. Fish is very, very tricky. I think it's some, you know, clams and oysters are good. That's like a form of aquaculture that works. Salmon farms, not so good. When we can manage fisheries, as we seem to be able to do with Pacific salmon to at least some extent, I think we can manage to not fish out the entire oceans. But, you know, it's an incredible thing to say the United States is the most progressive country in the world in fisheries management. And it's not that progressive, but it's the most progressive in the world. Everybody else cheats way more than we do. And so it's an international problem. And now you're not even into questions of food or justice, you're into questions of global government, because I don't know how you keep the Russians, the Spanish, and the Japanese from overfishing. I have no idea. You're not going to go to war over fisheries, so nor am I suggesting that we should, in case someone might misconstrue what I just said. But I don't know what the answer is, fish-wise.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about how trade agreements affect food. You've written about that recently. There's two major trade agreements that are currently under discussion. And people often, you know, their eyes kind of glaze over when they hear this topic, but they do actually impact food. If you want to just address that briefly.
The current trade agreements that are being negotiated are going to make it so that countries will have trouble passing progressive legislation around agriculture, because if you limit a company's right to do agriculture the way that it was doing, or to do marketing the way that it was doing, you can be sued. You will be able to be sued in a court outside of that country's jurisdiction. Or it can just be as simple as throwing your weight around. I mean, we're negotiating a transatlantic partnership. The Trans-Pacific Partnership's the one in the news more, but we're negotiating a transatlantic partnership right now, and we are dictating to the Europeans what kind of chemicals are acceptable in agriculture, because we're saying you're going to have to import our stuff as part of this agreement, and these are the pesticides that we're going to use, or chemicals we're going to use, and even if you don't use them, we're going to use them, and you can't have rules that say we can't use them. So this kind of stuff is really very weighty, in the sense of corporations throwing their weight around, really, because it's not being dictated by governments, it's being dictated by multinationals.
At this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Naomi Starkman, founder and editor-in-chief of Civil Eats, and your moderator for tonight's program. Our guest tonight is New York Times food columnist Mark Bittman, discussing his latest book, A Bone to Pick.
Nicely read.
Thank you. So here's a great question. The climate and soil here allow for great produce and variety. Which do you think is better, transporting California produce around the country and actually around the world, or developing plants genetically to allow greater variety to be grown?
That's not an either-or question. I'm sorry. I think it's great that California provides 50% of the fruits and vegetables of the United States. I think it would be better if it were 40%, or maybe even 30. And I think it would be better if the Northeast redeveloped some of its agriculture, the Southeast redeveloped some of its agriculture. The parts of the country where water is abundant are natural places to produce food that's very thirsty. And California is not a good place to produce food that's very thirsty. So as water becomes this, I think this was my column today, actually.
It is.
starting to sound very familiar.
As water becomes more expensive, as it will, as it becomes scarcer, food grown using large amounts of water in places where water is expensive is going to become more expensive. So it will then appear to be, it will be, more competitive to produce that food in places like New England and the upper Midwest and the mid-Atlantic states and the Southeast, places that were agricultural strongholds until industrial agriculture really took over, and, you know, the heart of the Midwest, Iowa, and California really started to dominate the agricultural scene in the United States. I think there's no choice but to go back to a form of regional agriculture. I don't think that at all means that California is not going to be the agricultural powerhouse that it is. But I think there are some things that are better to grow in California and some things that make less sense to grow in California. And we're learning that. I mean, you just, it's a young country. I mean, who knows how long it took France to figure this stuff out. But it's a much older country. We're learning that.
You wrote a column about your ideal food label. And we hear a lot in the news about food labels and what they mean and what they don't mean. Can you talk to us a little bit about your dream label? Has it changed? Would you add anything to it?
I don't remember it by heart, but I don't think it has changed. I think my dream food label still says how close to the original food is this food? I call that its foodness. We give it a foodness score. How well or badly was the labor treated that produced this food? Is this food organic or whatever other standard you want to apply? That is, how many chemicals were used in producing it? Does this food have traces of chemicals or traces of antibiotics in it? What else is there? Carbon footprint? I mean, make a list. I mean, it was a dream food label. So far, 0% of it has been achieved. So it doesn't matter how long the list is, because 0% of 100 is the same as 0% of 10. When you have a victory, you push for more. We haven't had any victories in labeling. Someone must want to know my opinion about GMO labeling, so I'll give it. Which is that, that's the labeling we'll probably see first. And it's, in my opinion, the least important of all the things I just mentioned. But people do want to know whether food's been made with genetically engineered ingredients. And to me, it's a victory because it would be about transparency, and it would lead to people saying, well, okay, now that I know whether my food's genetically engineered, can I find out whether antibiotics were used in the production of this, or can I find out how many pesticide residues there are on here, or whatever you care about. I mean, whatever you care about, I care about it too. I mean, we mostly all do. We have different priorities, but, I met a pesticide expert who's spent 20 years studying the effect of pesticides on farm workers. And she said to me, the effect of pesticide on farm workers is profound, but it's actually not more profound than the effect of pesticides on eaters, all of us. And there's no big movement to label things based on how many pesticides were used in its production or what pesticide residues are. And now there are, I don't want to get too technical or wonky or too deep into this, but now there are systemic, I say pesticides, I should just say chemicals, because pesticides, herbicides, fungicides are all sort of in the same camp. There are systemic chemicals used in agriculture now that are designed to go into the plant, to reside in the plant. It's not just crop dusting. You know, we think, okay, they're dusting this crop, so if you wash it off, it's okay. Or if I eat a banana, it doesn't matter because the pesticides, the chemicals were sprayed on the outside, they didn't go inside. No, chemicals are now being made that are systemic, therefore they're coming up through the roots and into the very tissue of the stuff that you're eating. You can't wash it off. You probably know more about this than I do.
Well, you said in the past, you've made this case also pretty strongly that you want, hopefully people can afford organic, but if they can't, they should eat more fruits and vegetables. What are we talking about when we're talking about making food that's good, clean, and fair, affordable and accessible to the masses?
As I said before, you're not talking about food issues anymore, you're talking about social justice issues. If food is more expensive, and it should be more expensive, then people need to have adequate incomes to pay for it. I mean, food, I don't know whether people think food is a right or not, but it is a basic condition of human life. So if we all believe that we're a society and we care about each other, we should care whether we all have the means to meet basic conditions of decent lives. I think that means that people do have a right to good food. And if that means they have a right to a guaranteed basic income, then we should determine what that guaranteed basic income is, and we should make sure people have it. That's, you could applaud for that.
Let's talk a little bit about antibiotics. So you mentioned earlier, you said, you know, we haven't seen a lot in terms of government action, but we have seen quite a bit, and you all have probably been very familiar hearing about a lot of industry and producer push. Some of it is questionable, as you've noted, but Purdue, Tyson, Foster Farms, McDonald's making commitment to reduce its amount of antibiotics in its chicken. Do you think this is sort of a tipping point? Is it consumers driving this demand? Do you think it will be pushed even a little bit further? Where are you sort of seeing antibiotics? And do you think, I mean, obviously Obama's only in office now, and even with the directive that he issued yesterday, he called on all federal eateries to source their meat using responsible use of antibiotics. Obama's only in office for a little bit left here. Where do you think this issue is going to go?
I think that the companies are responding to the writing on the wall, but I think that they're figuring out that they can raise their chickens without antibiotics. Having said that, first of all, we're only talking about chickens. Second of all, they're phasing out antibiotics, so it's sort of the same thing as the phasing in of the minimum wage in Los Angeles, although I actually believe the minimum wage in Los Angeles will be phased in, whereas I don't know that I believe that antibiotics will be phased out. They've promised to reduce antibiotic use before. They've promised to end antibiotic use. But this isn't the first time McDonald's has said we're going to buy chicken without antibiotics in it. So, A, there's no reason to believe them. B, even if you do believe them, it's going to be phased in over a long period of time. C, it's voluntary. Any one of them could change their mind any minute. They could say, oh, we changed their mind. We're going to double the amount of antibiotics we use. What has to happen is that the Food and Drug Administration has to say, you can no longer use antibiotics prophylactically in raising animals. So simple, and they have the power to do it. And they have not done it with arguably the most progressive president in the last 50 years. That's really a problem. I really thought that we would have seen the end of antibiotics in food production by now, but we haven't, and I'm frankly discouraged. And this thing that happened yesterday, which you just mentioned, which was so not in the news that I didn't know about it, and I'm supposed to know these things, it's just more gobbledygook. Balderdash, I think, is probably.
Let's talk a little bit about soda tax.
Oh, my favorite.
Well, you're in Berkeley now. You're a Berkeleyite. Soda tax, you mentioned it's law in Mexico. You tweeted today that the United Kingdom's thinking about putting a tax on sugar. France, other countries are doing this.
Considering this.
What's holding us up here?
Big food. They will fight every single, you know, it could only pass in Berkeley because Berkeley is kind of a wacky place. But I think Mexico is more interesting than Berkeley. I mean, from this perspective, Mexico passed a 10% tax on soda and junk food that started January 1st, 2014. In 2014, junk food was ill-defined. It's very hard to define junk food, especially since they snuck that part of the law in the last 2 weeks, and you can't have any kind of legislature that can then define junk food in time to enforce this. But sugar-sweetened beverage is pretty easy to define. Mexico saw a 10% decrease in the consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages last year and a 12% increase in the consumption of bottled water. Really amazing. Mexico is a real country. I mean, people here tend to think of, not here in California, people here in the United States think of Mexico as, you know, third world and poor, and of course it has problems, blah, blah, but we have problems too. And we are virtually in a tie with Mexico for per capita consumption of sugar and obesity rates. So we have nothing on Mexico when it comes to public health in that regard. We could stand to have some kind of regulation about sugar consumption, soda consumption in this country that goes a lot farther than Berkeley. And I could remind you all that because of the phrasing of San Francisco soda tax, it lost, but it did win a majority of votes. It just needed a two-thirds, needed a supermajority because of the way it was written. And it was written very well, very intelligently, but perhaps too good for, too intelligently, too strongly for its own good. If it had been written like Berkeley soda tax, it would have passed. So we will see a city that's more representative, bigger than Berkeley, pass a soda tax in the next couple of years, I think. And then we'll have some data, and it'll show that soda consumption goes down, and 5 years later, it'll show that childhood obesity goes down. I'm sure of that.
Interestingly, San Francisco lawmakers just discussed requiring soda advertisements to include a health warning. What do you think about that?
That passed?
If they're discussing it right now.
Oh, well, tell me when it passes. I have lots of ideas that won't go anywhere. I mean, the state Senate voted down a labeling on, you know, a health warning on cans of soda, which is really smart. I mean, my idea is, you card kids under 16. You can't buy soda if you're under 16 without your parents' permission. That'll work.
They're making it illegal in Davis now to give kids soda, which is pretty radical for
some. They're not making it illegal.
Well, if
they're
offered.
They're making it so you have to request it.
You do, but so if you can be fined.
It's illegal for me to have this glass of water because I didn't ask for it, actually.
It's true.
Right?
So, we'll talk to management about that. One last question, exactly. People always want to know, and there are a lot of questions about this, what they can do to change the food system. Some practical advice.
Well, I think there's two levels, and I think I can do this question quickly because we've talked about both of these things. One is you change the way you eat, because that does have an impact, and if we did that, if we were united around doing that, it would have a huge impact. We're not going to be, but any individual who wants to can develop his or her own personal food policy and enact it starting tomorrow. And it doesn't have to be perfect, and it doesn't have to be consistent, and you can screw up and all of that, but it's follow those two rules I was talking about before about eating less junk and more fruits and vegetables, and you're in business. And then the rest is be politically active, whatever that means to you. As I said, work for your kids' school lunch program, work for progressive change on a municipal county level, talk to those Congress, you know, get progressive Congress people elected, people who care about food elected, and, you know, that's pretty much it. I mean, I don't organize.
Our thanks to New York Times food columnist Mark Bittman for discussing his latest book, A Bone to Pick, here with us tonight, and to the Bernard Osher Foundation for underwriting this program. I'm Naomi Starkman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you.